But in Washington, saying, have a great week.
Today is Monday, September the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Democrats push through a $3.5 trillion 10-year spending bill that strengthens social safety net and climate programs through the House Budget Committee. However, Democratic leaders acknowledged that they didn't have the votes for a full House vote that was expected on Monday.
You cannot choose the date. You have to go when you have the votes in a reasonable time, and we will.
Switzerland voted Sunday to allow same-sex marriage.
The government also welcomed the result, saying it put an end to current existing inequalities in the treatment of people and an end to the imposition of the state on how its citizens should lead their lives.
And latest exit polls from Germany's election are showing a tight race between Germany's center-left Social Democrats and outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right bloc. We have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Democrats have pushed a $3.5 trillion 10-year bill that strengthens social safety net and climate programs through the House Budget Committee. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
In an unusual virtual meeting Saturday, the panel approved the measure on a near party line vote, 20-17. Illustrating the challenges Democratic leaders face in uniting the party, one Democrat, Scott Peters of California, joined the 16 Republicans on the Budget Committee in opposing the legislation. The $3.5 trillion measure embodies President Biden's domestic aspirations, strengthening social safety net and climate programs. But the approval marks just a minor procedural advance toward debate by the full House. And Democratic leaders are still hunting for compromises to resolve the divisions within the party. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi acknowledged that she didn't have the votes to bring the bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill up for a vote on Monday.
Let me just say we're going to pass the bill this week. I promised that we would bring the bill to the floor. That was according to the language that those who wanted this to be brought to the floor tomorrow wrote into the rule. We will bring the bill to the floor tomorrow for consideration. But you know, I'm never bringing a bill to the floor that doesn't have the votes. And I think any time you put an arbitrary date, you cannot choose the date. You have to go when you have the votes in a reasonable time, and we will.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Women leaders addressed the United Nations General Assembly, saying that it's time for the world to fight for gender parity, especially with the global pandemic and endemic climate change. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
In her speech to the UN General Assembly, Slovakian President Zuzana Čaputová says gender-based and race-based violence are just as serious threats to the world as the pandemic and climate change.
We cannot save our planet if we leave out the vulnerable, the women, the girls, the minorities. The silent pandemic of gender-based violence can prove lethal to the health of our societies.
Čaputová is just one of 13 women to address the General Assembly, four more than last year, but still less than 10% of the speakers. There are also 24 women heads of state or national governments. That's three more than 2020, but far less than the 193 member states in the UN. I'm Tim McGuire.
And the latest exit polls from Germany's election are showing a tight race between Germany's center-left Social Democrats and outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right bloc. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has more.
According to projections, Merkel's centre-right bloc is heading towards its worst ever result in the country's parliamentary election. One projection by public television ZDF puts the Social Democrats, headed by outgoing Vice-Chancellor Olaf Scholz, in the lead at 25.6% of the votes. The same poll puts Merkel's union bloc, led by State Governor Armin Laschet, trailing behind at 24.4%. Given the exit poll predictions, putting together the next coalition government for Europe's biggest economy could be a lengthy and complicated process. I'm Karen Chamas.
Voice of America!
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. South Korea has argued North Korea to reactivate cross-border communication lines between the neighboring countries. AP correspondent Karen Chamas joins us again with this story.
South Korea has urged North Korea to reactivate cross-border communication lines between the neighboring countries. The move comes a day after North Korea repeated an offer to open conditional talks. Kim Yo-jung, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, had said the previous day that if South Korea abandons hostile policies, talks could resume. She didn't elaborate on what specific steps she wants South Korea to take, but many believe the North wants South Korea to help with sanctions relief from the US. The warming atmosphere comes weeks after North Korea carried out its first missile test in 6 months. I'm Karen Chamas.
Crisis hit Lebanon is facing another challenge that adds up to the major economic meltdown. Medical doctors and nurses are fleeing the country by dozens because of the difficult living and working conditions. While patients struggle to find the needed medical care, the WHO has warned that Lebanon needs support to face this new challenge. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
The situation in Lebanon gets harder every day. The unprecedented economic crisis has forced Lebanese doctors to abandon their jobs and their country to look for a decent life elsewhere. The WHO's regional director for the Eastern Mediterranean, Dr. Ahmed Al-Mandari, who visited Beirut last week, declared that 2,000 medical doctors and 1,500 registered nurses have left Lebanon, while 600 private pharmacies have closed down. Analysts say the number is even higher. Medical doctor Hannah Fahed, who left Lebanon to settle in Paris, explained that he had no choice because life conditions were unbearable in Beirut.
2020, the year that we lived in Lebanon as doctors, was very hard from the manifestations and the riot. We were treating the injured, and then the COVID situation left us really exhausted. Then came the explosion, and we had to work we had to put our feelings aside and work day and night with the injured. So I think at the end of 2020, I was really exhausted physically, emotionally, mentally, and I had to leave.
Today, getting a hold of a good doctor has become hard in Lebanon, the country that was once called the hospital of the Middle East, as it offered very efficient medical care, is today in dire need of medical staff, and citizens dread the idea of falling ill. Therese, who had to look for a new doctor after her own family doctor left the country, says it was almost impossible to find what she was looking for. She is saying, when I fell pregnant, I wanted to go back to the medical doctor I usually visited. I was surprised to know he left the country. I took a month to find another doctor, and I was surprised again to read a post for him on Facebook saying that he too has decided to leave the country. He complained that doing his job was not easy anymore in Lebanon. He could not find fuel to reach his clinic sometimes, so eventually he decided to pack his bags and leave. WHO continues to work to support the health system and delivery of essential services and supplies. However, even medicine as basic as paracetamol is hard to find in Lebanon these days. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
In Switzerland, a controversial same-sex marriage referendum has been resoundingly approved by voters of the conservative, rich Alpine country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nearly two-thirds of Swiss citizens, more than 64%, have voted to legalize same-sex marriage and grant gay and lesbian couples the same rights as heterosexual partners. All 26 Swiss cantons, even the most traditional Appenzell-Innerrhoden, accepted the proposal. Backers of the same-sex marriage campaign erupted into applause and cheers when the results were announced. A member of the marriage campaign committee, Matthias Erhard, called the outcome a big achievement and the crowning vote of a 40-year struggle in the country for same-sex marriage equality. The government also welcomed the result, saying it put an end to current existing inequalities in the treatment of people and an end to the imposition of the state on how its citizens should lead their lives. Under the new law, same-sex couples in Switzerland will be able to jointly adopt children. Lesbian couples can access sperm donations and medically assisted procreation. Opponents of the initiative said this provision threatens the well-being of children and effectively deprives children conceived by a sperm donor of the right to a father. Swiss law does not allow the identity of a sperm donor to be revealed until the child reaches the age of 18. The Swiss People's Party National Councillor Verena Herzog said the new law opens the floodgates to many potentially dangerous practices. Herzog warned the expansion of reproductive medicine has not just opened a small door, but a garage door has been opened. She said homosexual men also will want to be able to benefit from reproductive medicine.
Die Verfassung gebrochen.
Opponents say they will not abandon the issue, noting that the matter could come up for another vote in the future simply by gathering 50,000 signatures of Swiss citizens. The outcome of the vote makes Switzerland the 30th country worldwide to allow same-sex marriage. Switzerland's Minister of Justice says the first gay and lesbian marriage ceremonies will be allowed as of July 2022. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, thousands of British gas stations ran dry on Sunday as motorists scrambled to fill up amid a supply disruption due to a shortage of truck drivers. Reports say that the Petrol Retailers Association, which represents almost 5,500 independent outlets, say that about two-thirds of its members were reporting that they had sold out their fuel, with the rest partly dry and running out soon. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Funganyi. Social media giant Facebook has agreed to send their global head of safety to testify before the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection at the end of this month. The hearing comes after the Wall Street Journal published an article revealing Facebook's own research had showed that its Instagram app had a negative impact on young people's mental health. A New York University Stern Center for Business and Human Rights has published the study titled Fueling the Fire: How Social Media Intensified U.S. Political Polarization and What Can Be Done About It. The report calls for Congress and the Biden administration to mandate more disclosure about the inner workings of the platforms and require that social media platforms share data on their ranking, recommendation, and removal algorithms for researchers and regulators to use. Paul Barrett, who is the deputy director at the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, co-authored the report. In this second part of my conversation with Mr. Barrett, he tells me that social media companies need to consider adjustments on how they are managed.
Right now, the federal government is suing Facebook, Google, other tech companies under antitrust laws. And the claim there is the companies are simply so big that they're dangerous to the larger economy and society. I don't know how those cases are going to come out, but those lawsuits implicitly raise the same question. Are you able to manage this company in its current form such that it's a net positive for society as opposed to a negative?
Mm. And, you know, part of your recommendation, I guess, is that government plays a role in these social media platforms. They're creating their own. And my question is, how do you make sure that the engagement on these platforms that you're suggesting is more authentic and not about people trying to get more likes or creating a viral moment? What are some of the design changes needed on these platforms to avoid the same mistakes that we're seeing right now?
Well, starting with the potential government role, right now, the government in this country plays almost no role in overseeing social media. That makes the social media industry anomalous. I mean, broadcast television and radio are overseen by the FCC. The equity markets, the stock markets, are overseen by the SEC. And then you've got the Federal Election Commission, on and on. There is no one body that, as an ongoing, sustained matter, keeps an eye on social media. So that's the starting point. I think we are now at the point where we have to conclude that this industry is not going to self-regulate itself sufficiently So the government needs to entertain some type of constructive role. And the first step, I think, is for the government to require a much greater degree of transparency, which is to say, the government will not have anything to say about particular pieces of content or types of content. In this country, we can't do that. First Amendment, free speech. Facebook is a private speaker in that sense and needs to be allowed to do what it wants to do. But the First Amendment does not stop the government from saying, we want you to disclose how your algorithms work so that we can get a better idea why one person sees one news feed and another person sees a very different news feed. How is it the decisions are made about ranking, recommending, and removing content? And once we had a better idea of just exactly how these automated systems worked, I think we could make much more informed decisions about whether, for example, it's really a good idea to have a whole system of rewards for virality. Is it absolutely necessary to have a system of likes and dislikes, to allow people to necessarily share everything? Maybe there should be more impediments placed before the user, before that person is able to share. I mean, for example, Twitter has already done this to a slight degree. If you go on Twitter and a tweet contains a link to an article and you go to share, retweet that article, it before you can retweet it, Twitter asks you, are you sure you want to retweet it even though you haven't read the article yet? Okay, that's a good first step. That should slow people down a little bit, make them think a little bit. I think a lot more experiments along those lines are needed. And the only way to make those experiments useful or potentially productive is for the regulators and the public and everyone to understand better how these systems actually work.
WhatsApp is very popular in Africa, actually, in developing countries. I've seen that WhatsApp has part of its safeguards limited how many people you can share one single story. And I think that is limiting the virality of some of these fake stories. I've been reading that, and I know that Americans are really good at functioning without appeals to power. Is there a private sector solution to this public threat, that, as you say?
Well, in theory, there ought to be. In theory, the major tech platforms could self-regulate more effectively. One of the problems with these platforms, though, is I fear that in their short lives, they're all, in the range of 15 years old or so, that they have become more complicated and more vast than their founders anticipated. And the people running these companies simply don't fully have their arms around them, are not able to deal with all the challenges that they face. I am not in favor of the government taking over the companies or the government dictating how they're managed on a day-to-day basis. No, I think that would be a bad idea and dangerous. But I think if we understood more about how the companies functioned, that would create demands from the public, from political leaders and others, that the companies consider adjustments to how they're managed.
That was Mr. Paul Barrett. He's the deputy director of the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Funganyi. Fossilized footprints discovered in New Mexico indicate that early humans were walking across North America around 23,000 years ago. Rick Pantaleo joins us with this Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's thought that the first humans entered the Americas about 13,000 years ago during the last ice age by crossing a land bridge that once linked Siberia with what is now Alaska. Some scientists have theorized that humans were in the Americas long before then. A 2017 Nature study suggested that humans or their ancestors were in the Americas some 130,000 years ago. A new study published in the journal Science and led by researchers at the UK's Bournemouth University provides evidence of human activity 23,000 years ago in what is now White Sands National Park in New Mexico. The researchers studied the fossilized footprints of children, teens, and adults that were gathered by the U.S. Geological Survey in 2009. The study suggests the footprints were formed in soft mud on the shores of what was once a shallow lake. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is defending President Joe Biden's foreign policy record as the administration faces pressure over its handling of Haitian migrants on the U.S. border, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the nuclear submarine deal with Australia that angered France. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Sidi Saint.
Help lead the world toward a more President Joe Biden told the United Nations General Assembly this week that the world is at an inflection point, and he vowed to pivot from an era of relentless wars to an era of relentless diplomacy, with the United States committed to multilateral institutions like the UN. But the recent hurried U.S. departure from Afghanistan, with an untold number of Afghans who helped the United States left behind, is just one of multiple foreign policy challenges the White House has faced in recent weeks. At the UN, Secretary of State Antony Blinken faced some tough questions on Biden's foreign policy challenges.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, this new security agreement between Australia, the U.S., and the U.K. that enraged the French, the border crisis.
Blinken said everyone he had spoken with at the UN has expressed appreciation for Biden's foreign policy vision.
The United States that is determined to work closely with other countries. The United States that understands that not a single one of the big problems and challenges we face, that our people face, the ones we've talked about from COVID to climate to the disruptive impact of emerging technologies, not a single one can be addressed by any of us acting alone.
But most experts agree the Biden administration has had some foreign policy setbacks, including angering France. Brian Katulis is with the Center for American Progress.
Certainly the center of gravity for this new administration's focus has been at home in dealing with the pandemic and vaccines and the economic situation. So much of the president's personal time, even though he was speaking at the United Nations this week, I think much of his time this week will be spent trying to discuss with Congress and convince them of his infrastructure plan and the social safety net.
Other experts say Biden is focused like a laser on solving problems at home, sometimes to the detriment of his foreign policy execution. Aaron David Miller is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
First, it distracts him. It makes him stubbornly and I think willfully focused on turning his attention to what he wants to do, and that is to become a transformative president at home.
Katulis said some long-term problems at the State Department have likely also played a role.
I do think that there's just some institutional decay inside of especially the civilian side of the U.S. diplomacy and State Department. This is nothing new and not even related to the Biden administration or even Trump. It's a longstanding problem of these organizations, essentially since 9/11, being overshadowed by both the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies.
Congress may also be partly to blame. Christopher Scaluba of the Atlantic Council told VOA.
in the State Department, within the Defense Department. I think there is still a little bit of a recovery going on from the neglect of the Trump years. And also, for whatever reason, the confirmation of the senior people in many of these positions have been slow. The administration was somewhat slow to nominate people, and now the Congress is very slow in confirming them. And so when I think about transatlantic security in particular, we don't have a NATO ambassador.
Blinken, who grew up in Paris, has vowed to work hard to restore the close U.S. relationship with France, saying it will take some time. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Top Iraqi government officials are rejecting calls by a group of 300 prominent tribal leaders and other past and present dignitaries at a meeting in the Iraqi Kurdistan city of Erbil to normalize ties with Israel. The Iraqi Prime Minister's office issued a statement Saturday calling the meeting, which took place Friday, illegal. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi TV reported Saturday afternoon that Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi's office issued a statement rejecting a call by a group of 300 dignitaries to normalize ties with Israel. It added that the statement called the meeting, which took place Friday in the Kurdish capital of Erbil, illegal. Arab media indicated that Parliament Speaker Mohammed Halbousi and one of his deputies are also rejecting the call, along with Iraqi President Barham Saleh. The meeting was sponsored by a U.S. peace advocacy group led by Joseph Browday, a Jewish American whose family fled Baghdad during the 1940s. Browday told the conference that those gathered in Erbil have made a courageous decision. He says that he supports the efforts of courageous leaders from six Iraqi provinces, Baghdad, Anbar, Mosul, Salahuddin, Babel, and Diyala, declaring with conviction their desire to enter into the framework of the Abrahamic Accords between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. The head of the Sunni Sahwa movement, Wissam Hardan, told the conference that Iraq's federal system permitted different regions to express their support for normalizing ties with Israel. He says that given Iraq's federal system of government, various parties are expressing their desire to normalize ties with Israel and tighten relations with the Israeli people. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that the meeting in Erbil to discuss Iraq improving ties with Israel caused an uproar in Baghdad, but that it could be a sign of things to come. It could be an indication that the views on Israel are changing in some quarters of Iraq. Sullivan added that the Kurds who hosted the Friday conference to normalize ties with Israel have always been more open to Israel than other populations in Iraq. Several Kurdish leaders backtracked on the conference after hearing of opposition from Baghdad, however, claiming that they weren't aware of the exact nature of the conference and that its organizers misled those attending about its intent. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV, which covered the meeting, suggested that it may be intended to test the waters inside Iraq for public reaction to normalizing ties with Israel. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. And be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. At voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great week ahead.
VOA. We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
Hey,
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.